Welcome to the next Wilmington History Society podcast. I'm Nathan Field, here with Bill Knightley. Before we get started, let me just give some quick background on the Wilmington History Society for those who may be tuning in for the first time. Ben Rapkin and myself founded the organization in early 2018, and our goal was to generate more community spirit and excitement in and interest about Wilmington. And our main activity since we started is a monthly happy hour speaker event at the Chelsea Tavern. We've rented the basement bar and hosted a speaker on some Wilmington history related topic, and you can find a description of all of these events on the website, which is wilmingtonhistorysociety.com. So many people have been coming out to these events. I think it really goes to show that people want to be excited about Wilmington again. And I'll put this out there because I've said this several times. We're trying to always expand and consider other activities that further the above goals. So if anybody has an idea for some sub-activity that's related to what we're trying to do, we are always all ears. A note on the podcasts, we started them about a month ago after coronavirus shut down our in-person events. And the idea is to kind of keep the momentum going and to have fun and keep spreading information and excitement about Wilmington. Where can you find the podcasts? There are four ways. The first is Facebook, which the link is at Wilmington History Society. The second is the Podbean app, which is wilmingtonhistorysociety.podbean.com, and all of them will be always posted there. You can listen directly there. Third is the Wilmington History Society website, again, wilmingtonhistorysociety.com. And fourth, if you are not good with social media, just send me an email and tell me you'd like to be sent each podcast as it comes out, and I'll be happy to do that. Before we jump into the third podcast with Bill, let me give a description of the first two. We started off with a podcast on Wilmington during the colonial era. Bill shared his research on that topic. We talked about, among other things, why did Napoleon coming to power change the nature of Wilmington? The rivalry between the 2nd Street and 4th Street markets? And what was the city's tavern scene like in 1750? That set the stage for the second podcast, which focused on Wilmington during the Revolutionary War itself. Bill has done a tremendous amount of research on this topic. We talked about the major military figures from American history that came to Wilmington in the second half of 1777, including George Washington, James Monroe, the Marquis de Lafayette, the Battle of Brandywine, which took place and was to some extent directed from Wilmington, and among other things, the kidnapping of the governor of Delaware from the streets of Quaker Hill by the British. This third podcast will talk about a major figure from this period, the Marquis de Lafayette, a 19-year-old Frenchman that played a major role in the American Revolutionary War. Bill has done a tremendous amount of research on Lafayette, and that is going to be the subject of this third podcast. Bill, how are you doing today?
Hi, Nathan. I'm doing fine.
Let's start by talking about the man himself. Who was Lafayette? Why is he important? What brought him to America and Wilmington?
Right. Well, I think, as you said, I think our listeners are going to be really surprised at the relationship that Lafayette had with the city of Wilmington. Of course, then it was a town when he first came here. You know, one point before we start, I gotta let you know I'm biased in this subject. I'm a real Lafayette fan and admirer, and I find that the more I read about the man, the more I like him. He is really a character of his age, a unique figure, and an admirable figure overall, I believe. I think I can make that case for him. It's almost impossible for us to imagine how revered a figure he became in America, especially after the Revolution. Of course, when he first came here, he was unknown. He was a 19-year-old Frenchman that nobody knew. And as we'll see in this podcast, when he returned a number of times to the United States and to Wilmington, he got a reception that I can only compare to maybe the Apollo astronauts. I mean, it's on that level, it's on that scale. And he was beloved, revered, admired. people had plates, they had towels with his image on it, you know, paper with his image on it. He was quite popular in this country. In fact, I just can't think of another figure that received more adulation, especially in Wilmington, than he did. Now, who was he? He was a very rich man. He was one of the richest men in France. He married into a lot of money. He was from a royal family. He was 19 years old, though, so you got to think to yourself, how much experience, how much background did this guy have? But he was very idealistic, and he ends up coming to America to support the revolution. He believed in the rights of man, he believed in liberty, and a lot of people also came with him, a lot of people from different countries, and their motivations weren't always so pure. A lot of people came for land, they came for glory, they came for money. I wouldn't say that Lafayette didn't come for some glory, but his motivation seemed to be a lot higher, a lot purer, if you will, than some of his counterparts. He actually told George Washington when he arrived, he said, "I'm here to learn, not to teach." And I think that had an impact on Washington, because that a little less arrogant than some of his counterparts when they came. One of his biographers, I think, kind of succinctly summed him up as a person. He said he lived in treacherous times and made imperfect choices. He failed at more ventures than most of us will ever attempt, and succeeded in efforts that stymied countless men. But he never abandoned the belief that he could change the world, and he never despaired of success. So he was an idealist. He remained an idealist throughout his life, but he made a huge impact here in America, both during the Revolution and I would say after the Revolution. He continued to have an enormous impact. In summary, he was a remarkable man, really in an age of remarkable men.
I want to ask you a couple of follow-up questions. Lafayette is rich. In 2020, if someone is really wealthy, you might call them private jet wealthy. Lafayette, in his time, was private ship wealthy. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. When he decided to come to the United States, or to America then, it wasn't the United States, of course, when he came, he couldn't get a ship. That was no problem. He just went out and purchased one. He bought a ship, and he brought with him 50 other Frenchmen, actually brought some Germans with him that would later serve in the Continental Army. But you could almost say money was no obstacle for him. So you have to really look, why is he coming here to do this? He didn't have to do this. He was rich beyond anybody's imagination, of course, in that era. And to get here, he just purchased his own ship, and that was not a problem to him. So he was definitely one of the richest men in France.
He's bought his own ship. He comes to America, and he arrives in Charleston, South Carolina, 1777. I understand that he had a special relationship with George Washington, and that relationship continued throughout their lives. How does a 19-year-old French nobleman, barely speaks English when he arrives, develop such a close relationship with the father of our country?
Well, when Washington first met him, and this occurred in Philadelphia July of 1777, you know, he wasn't really impressed with him. You know, he was just one of many foreign officers, mercenaries, if you will, that were coming to help us, if you could put help in quotation marks. So Washington, he didn't stand out right away to Washington. However, the reverse was not true. When Lafayette arrived in Philadelphia, he first saw Washington in the City Tavern, and he immediately was impressed with him. In fact, I have a quote here. He said, this is Lafayette, quote, "Although he was surrounded by officers and citizens, it was impossible to mistake for a moment his majestic figure and deportment, nor was he less distinguished by the noble affability of his manner," unquote. So the first time he laid eyes on Washington, Washington lit up the crowd. He just stood out, and he was very impressed with him, and he became his role model, and he said, "That's the kind of guy I want to be." Now, the feeling wasn't originally mutual, because Washington didn't really know what to do with all these Frenchmen, and the 19-year-old didn't necessarily stand out among the others. In fact, there were some legitimate generals from France in this group of generals that showed up in Philadelphia. But they became very, very close, and we can get into that a little bit later, how that happened. But it almost developed into a father-son relationship as they got to know each other. Lafayette's father was killed when he was 2 years old in the Seven Years' War. He died at the Battle of Minden. And so he really grew up fatherless. Washington didn't have any biological children. Now, he did have four children, stepchildren, that he raised as his own. They were Martha's children by a previous marriage, but he didn't have a son of his own, and he sort of looked at Lafayette as a son. And in fact, Lafayette, later in life, when he had a son, he named his son George Washington Lafayette, and he named his daughter Virginia, which was Washington's home state. In fact, Benjamin Franklin actually said he wished that Lafayette had had 13 children because he thought he could name each one of them after a colony. But in his memoirs, Lafayette says, quote, "Never was an adoption more complete than his own." So he felt that he eventually was accepted by George Washington. He felt like he was being treated like a son. In fact, when he's wounded at the Battle of the Brandywine, Washington sends his personal surgeon to attend to Lafayette, and he tells the surgeon, "I want you to treat this man like he was my son." So that relationship solidified very quickly. A lot of that relationship, by the way, was formed right here in Wilmington, because that's where Lafayette first deployed with the Continental Army as Washington's aide. So that relationship developed and was nurtured right here in the Wilmington area, and became a father-son relationship, and they kept that relationship throughout their lives. It was a very, very, very unique relationship.
I'm curious how, as you mentioned to me in a conversation before we started recording, on Lafayette's ship, there's 50 French officers coming over with him. How did Lafayette stick out? Did he have other Americans vouching for him to George Washington and other leaders of the Continental Army?
Yeah, well, what happened when he arrives in Philadelphia? Of course, you know, he lands in near Charleston, South Carolina, in June of 1777. He's about 50 miles away. He landed in the wrong spot, but he eventually gets to Charleston, and then he makes the 650-mile ride, which almost takes him a month in those days. It was hot, too. It was very, very humid, very hot at that time. Comes all the way up the East Coast on the King's Highway, arrives in Philadelphia. Now, he had been promised in Paris by a fellow named Silas Deane. Silas Deane was the representative of the colonies to Paris, to France, and, you know, we might look at him as an ambassador, if you will. But Silas Deane was writing checks he couldn't cash. He was promising all these foreign officers commissions in the Continental Army, and he was sort of doing it on his own, and these guys would then board ships and come to the United States expecting that all this was going to come true for them, and of course Lafayette was one of them. So Lafayette gets here, and there's nothing to distinguish him from the rest of these guys. In fact, he's probably less distinguished because of his age and his youth. But sometime during this period, in July of August of 1777, something changes, and I think what changed was that Benjamin Franklin, who in Paris knew Lafayette and knew his connections with the king and with the government of France, wrote a letter back to the Continental Congress saying, wait a minute, don't dismiss this young guy, because he is really connected and he is somebody who could really help the colonies vis-a-vis France with his influence, with his money, you know, with the people he knows. So with that, the Continental Congress grants Lafayette his commission as Major General. That's the highest rank you could be in the Continental Army, other than Washington, commander of the army. So he's granted his commission in August of 1777 as a Major General. Now, he's not given a command of any unit. He's actually put as an aide-de-camp to Washington, but that's how he stood out. And I think it's probably due to Franklin writing this letter back to the Continental Congress to say, take note of this guy, because we could use him later on.
So Franklin was basically, Franklin is thinking ahead to possible French intervention and thinking,
yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and as it turns out, he's right, because Lafayette does go back to France during the Revolutionary War and plead the case for the colonies and is instrumental in helping France enter the war on our side.
Bill, you're a retired colonel in the Army, and you know hierarchy is something that is part of the military. A 19-year-old major general, that's quite a high rank for somebody that's 19. Did that cause any were there any of the Americans that were not, you know, that were much older that were not that rank? Was there any problems that appointment caused?
Well, in those days, rank was all tied up with social status. And the higher your social status, it was always felt that the higher your rank should be. Of course, in the American Army, the modern American Army, and most armies, it's meritocracy. You know, it's you go through a rigorous selection training process, and you're promoted based on the merits, not on your family or your money or anything like that. But that was totally different back then. So I'm sure there were people that resented him jumping to the head of the line, if you will. But I think he was of such importance to the fledgling colonies that it was accepted. Now, he didn't get a command right away. I think if he had been given command of troops, it would have been a different story. There would have been some outright problems in the ranks, if you will, if he had been given command right away. But you can go back and read primary sources, and one of the things that sticks out is that Washington is continually mediating disputes among his generals about their rank, their seniority, their status. It gets to be a real distraction for him, and he gets kind of fed up with it after a while, but they were always backbiting each other about who was senior to who. So throwing foreign officers in the mix could not have been helpful. But in this case, since he was made an aide initially to Washington, it probably was overlooked, if you will. But what happens eventually, as most people know, Lafayette distinguishes himself at the Battle of Brandywine. In fact, is wounded at the Battle of the Brandywine. And his credibility rises with Washington and actually with his fellow officers, that they completely accept him.
Lafayette is known as a lifelong believer in liberty, the rights of man, the cause of freedom. How does a man like this react to the institution of slavery that he would have found prevalent in America in 1777 and after the Revolution during his subsequent trips? He's a big admirer of George Washington, who owns slaves. Is there a hidden contradiction here?
Yes, I think there must have been. And this is probably a subject for a whole separate podcast because it's so complicated. But bottom line is that Lafayette hated the institution of slavery. He developed close relationships with abolitionists. He not only spoke out against it, but he actually acted, as we'll see. You know, there's one incident during the Revolutionary War where he was going to sail back to France to actually lobby France to come in on the side of the colonists, and he was going to sail from Boston. And the ship was ready to go, but it didn't have a crew. And the captain said, "Well, don't worry, we're going to go out and impress a crew," sort of a version of white slavery, if you will. And Lafayette said, "Absolutely not, I won't sail on such a ship." And they ended up having to get British prisoner volunteers to crew that ship to take him back. But he was absolutely opposed to any form of slavery, no matter what form it took. Now, how did that play out with Washington? Washington was a slave owner. Washington, unfortunately, he lived in an age, he came from a state, Virginia, where that was the norm. And he had slaves throughout his life. So you have to wonder if there weren't some real awkward moments in that relationship between Lafayette and George Washington. In fact, you know, I've read letters back and forth between them, where Lafayette is sort of goading him to move in a different direction. In fact, there is one point where Lafayette actually sends a letter to Washington. This is after the Revolution, suggesting that they both invest in a plantation solely for the purpose of emancipating the slaves in that plantation and using the plantation as a training ground and an educational institution so that the slaves, the former slaves, can be educated, be taught agricultural techniques, and be self-sufficient. And Washington kind of puts him off on this, and what Lafayette ends up doing is he ends up acting. He ends up actually doing it himself. He didn't do it in the United States. He did it in South America, in what I think it's now French Guiana, Cayenne, they called it. He goes down and he buys a plantation, and he emancipates those slaves and tries to carry out his idea of training and emancipating them. So it was an issue. Now you have to wonder, because on Washington's, later in his life, when he's dying in his will, he does emancipate all his slaves. And it was very complicated, believe it or not, in the state of Virginia, because, you know, Martha Washington, when they got married, she brought slaves to the marriage, and Washington had authority over his own slaves, but not hers. So he put in the will that all the slaves would be released upon both of their deaths. And I think he did that because he didn't want to break up the families of those slaves, which could have happened. But you have to wonder if that change of heart was as a result of Lafayette. Lafayette, during the American Revolution, developed a very close relationship with a man named James Armistead. And James Armistead was a slave, and he was working as a spy to infiltrate the British headquarters. And he was very successful. And Lafayette says it's the information that James Armistead developed that enabled the army to be successful at Yorktown. So at the end of the Revolution, you know, any slave that had served in the army was supposed to be emancipated. But they overlooked James Armistead because he technically wasn't a soldier. He was working as a spy. So Lafayette got involved in this, and there's a whole other story that it could be a separate discussion about how he intervenes on the part of Armistead, but it was successful, and the Virginia legislature granted James Armistead his freedom. In fact, Armistead changed his name to James Armistead Lafayette, and it was all because of Lafayette. And, you know, 42 years later, when Lafayette visits the United States, I think he's in Richmond, and he picks Armistead out of a crowd and embraces him on his return visit. But the bottom line is that Lafayette was absolutely opposed to slavery at every turn. I think he used that feeling that he had to really influence George Washington. And there had to be some very interesting discussions between the two of them about slavery. And you have to think that it's Lafayette that really pushed Washington hard on that issue.
To have been a fly on the wall in some of those conversations must have been really interesting. Unfortunately, flies on the wall don't keep written records.
No, I might add one other thing. You know, the French weren't clean on this. You know, they had slaves in Haiti. And that's what caused the insurrection in 1791, when they all came up to Wilmington, the French people. And some of them brought their slaves with them. In fact, there's a very prominent family in Wilmington, Andre and Lorette Noel. Andre and Lorette became very prominent citizens. They were freed slaves from the French colony of Santo Domingo, or Haiti as we know it today.
Before I ask the next question, a note to listeners on the sound. Again, I mentioned this in the last podcast. Bill and I are recording from two different locations with two different microphones. In a pre-coronavirus world, we'd be sitting at the same table and it would be a lot easier. I think we're doing a pretty good job on the sound, but it's tricky trying to record over the internet from two different locations when probably half the country is also on the internet. And so if you hear one of our voices suddenly jump up or down, that is the cause. But bear with us. Bill, can you give me a two-minute summary of Lafayette's involvement in the Revolution from a pure military perspective? What battles is he in? As we talked about last time, he's at the Battle of Brandywine, which is his first taste of combat. And then
You know, as we've discussed, you know, he arrives in America in June of 1777. He gets to Philly the next month, and by August he's a major general, 1777. And lo and behold, right away, he's on his way to Wilmington. He comes to Wilmington on the 25th of August of 1777 with Washington as his aide-de-camp. As you mentioned, he lives with the Tatnall family at 1803. North Market. Washington has his headquarters down at 3rd and West, and you can imagine they're back and forth, you know, consulting and doing different things. And during this period, he's being mentored by George Washington. Now, it's difficult because when he arrived, he didn't speak English, or at least didn't speak very well. He studied it on the ship on the way over, but he wasn't fluent. And one of his translators, when he was in Wilmington, or as interpreters, is Alexander Hamilton, who was fluent in French. And later on, one of his interpreters becomes a lieutenant named James Monroe, who later becomes the president of the United States, who is also fluent in French. But Lafayette eventually does become fluent in French, and you can read some letters he's written later in life where he writes just like an American. He becomes very, very, he was good at languages. I think he spoke Greek and Latin, so probably English wasn't a big challenge for him. Anyway, he's in Wilmington. He's under the mentorship of George Washington, and his initial experience with Continental Army and his initial training all takes place within a 12-mile radius of Wilmington. First thing he does is ride down with Washington to Iron Hill, which is right on the border between Maryland and Delaware, and they observe the British landing at Head of Elk when the British landed their 15,000-plus man army down there. So he goes on that ride, and this is at a time when they think the main battle to stop the British is going to be fought in Wilmington. The entire Continental Army is here in Wilmington. The next thing he does after riding to Iron Hill with him is he rides up the Brandywine with Washington, and they do a reconnaissance all along the river. They go to Rockland, Delaware, they ride to Smith's Bridge, and they go all the way up to Chad's Ford. And as we discussed in a previous podcast, you know, Washington's using this Jacob Broom map, where he actually makes notations all along the way about the different fords and the different characteristics of the Brandywine River. And Lafayette is with him and being taught, if you will, being mentored by him. And as a result of that second reconnaissance, as we discussed in a previous podcast, Washington directs that two battalions, a battalion each be posted at what's now Smith's Bridge, which of course was a ford then, and at Rockland, Delaware, which was a ford. So there were Continental troops at both of those places. And you can bet that Lafayette was right there, you know, being trained with Washington when they were making all those observations and those troop dispositions. He later goes on to fight in the Battle of Brandywine when the British decide to try to move north. They move the entire army from Wilmington up to the Brandywine, and he's wounded at the Brandywine. He convalesces in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and then he returns and rejoins the army at Valley Forge. At this point, this is about December of 1777, he gets a command of a division, actually Virginia troops, as it were. And he then goes on to fight in a number of different campaigns, actually comes through Wilmington a number of different times during the Revolutionary War, and ultimately becoming one of the heroes at the Battle of Yorktown. In fact, Hamilton and him are both commanders at the Battle of Yorktown. And of course, that's an American victory. It involves a lot of French troops, which Lafayette was responsible, or partly responsible, for getting involved in the war. And he really solidifies his reputation as one of the better generals in the Revolutionary War and becomes a revered figure at the end of the war. So he's very popular, very competent, and very well known by the end of the Revolutionary War.
One question, and if there's anybody that would know this answer, it would be you. And when you're reading his, was there a particular tavern in Wilmington that Lafayette preferred?
Geez, that's a good question. During the period August and September 1777, when the Continental Army was based in Wilmington, I do know that the French officers stayed in taverns along Market Street, and that would tell me they stayed in the Sign of the Ship. So I would just extrapolate that he probably visited and caroused and, you know, had meals with them in the Sign of the Ship Tavern, which was, you know, probably the most prominent tavern in Wilmington. But I do know that the French officers were based in Market Street taverns. They were probably using every tavern in the city for the different officers of the time period. If you ask me, I'd probably put money on the Sign of the Ship.
So, but you never came across a juicy letter where he says, "Wow, that was an amazing party on Market Street last night." Nothing like that.
No, never found that.
All right, so revolution. The war ends. America gets its independence. What becomes of Lafayette? We don't hear too much about this part of his life. Assume he goes back to France. Does he enjoy the same popularity at home as he did in America?
Well, he's well known in France. But I would say no, he doesn't enjoy the same level of popularity. Now, France is about to go through its own upheaval with its own revolution. And a lot of the revolutionaries think that Lafayette's the ideal guy to lead them. you know, because he has this reputation for human rights and freedom and liberty. Washington, or correction, Lafayette, you know, he walks a fine line when he returns, because I think he can see that things have to change in France. He also sees that there are some radicals that could overturn that country and lead to significant violence, and he doesn't think that's the solution either. So he walks this sort of middle line where he favors a constitutional monarchy, which would be really revolutionary for France. But he doesn't see the need to completely do away with the monarchy, and he doesn't want to offend, I think, the some of the upper classes. He thinks he needs them, you know, France will need them to build this new sort of government in France. So what happens? He ends up not pleasing anybody. He ends up being suspected by the monarchist and rejected by the revolutionaries. And it gets so bad that during this period, he sees the writing on the wall, and he has to leave France. And he actually goes into exile. He goes to Belgium. I think this is in 1792. And what happens is Belgium really isn't the Belgium we know today. It's part of the Habsburg Austrian Netherlands, if you will. So he is actually arrested by monarchists in Belgium and put into prison in Austria, which he spends about 5 years in prison, and really not a great situation. So, you know, he ends up not pleasing anybody, and it's ironic that here he is trying to support a constitutional monarchy, and he can't please anybody. So he's put into prison, and our old friend Napoleon Bonaparte is the guy that gets him out of that prison. But, you know, Bonaparte doesn't want any competition with a popular guy like Lafayette, because he's still popular with some people in France. So he makes a provision that he not be involved in politics when he comes back. And although Lafayette sort of agrees to that, it just doesn't work. And Lafayette remains closely aligned with politics throughout his life in France, but not to the degree where he's going to be a major figure.
If he had not left and fled, would he have likely been... had his head chopped off in during the revolution?
No doubt about it. No doubt about it. He would have been executed. Yeah. That's for sure.
So he's lucky he was able to get away. So
yeah.
Now,
you know, I've really given you the Cliff Note versions of his life in France. I mean, there's a lot of nuance to this and a lot more detail, but you know, this really is the focus of our podcast. Mm-hmm. But people need to know that he had a very tumultuous time after the American Revolution. I mean, spending 5 years in jail, and there's all kinds of things that happened during that period. I mean, there was actually an attempt to free him from this prison, and that's a whole nother story, but it's he had a rough time for those 5 years.
Yeah. So now we come to the most interesting part of the discussion, Lafayette's returns to the United States and his ties to Wilmington. So let me set this up a bit for our listeners. This time it's 1824. The country has grown to 24 states. The new president is James Monroe. Monroe and the Congress decide to Lafayette on an official visit, some say his farewell tour of the United States. He accepts, and this is the venue that ultimately brings him back to Wilmington. What happened during this tour? How was he received throughout the country? How did Wilmington receive him?
Yeah, this is my favorite part of the little history on Lafayette here, because this is really an event that, I can't emphasize enough what a significant event this was and how important this was for Wilmington at the time. And frankly, how unknown it is today. I mean, it's amazing what happened during this period that nobody knows about. You know, there's a few people that know about it, but not many. And I think our listeners are just going to be surprised at what happened during this period. Well, as you say, it's 1824. President Monroe invites the 67-year-old Marquis de Lafayette to return to the United States and be actually officially thanked for everything he did during the American Revolution. And you have to remember, it's a time where they had their own greatest generation, if you will, and they're all dying off. All the people that fought in the Revolutionary War, they're pretty senior now. And many of them have died. In fact, Lafayette is the only surviving major general from the Revolutionary War in 1824. So it's a time of nostalgia, if you will, and patriotism. And he returns, and he's originally just going to do visit some of the original states, the original colonies, but he ends up visiting all 24 states. and this tour lasts for 14 months. Now, he is welcomed by literally hundreds of thousands of people wherever he goes. New York turned out 200,000 people to welcome him. I mean, it's incredible. As I said before, the only thing I can think of, it's like the Apollo astronauts when they had their ticker tape parades. I mean, that's how popular he is. And every place he goes. As a result of this tour in 1824 and 1825, there are 40 counties and towns and cities in the United States that are named after Lafayette. It's incredible. So how does he get to Wilmington? Well, part of this tour is he's going to come to Wilmington. So what happens in October of 1824, on the 6th of October, is the day he's scheduled to come to Wilmington. So he comes down from Philadelphia. And I've got a quote from one of my old favorites here from his diary, Father Kenny, the Catholic priest that was kind of the circuit priest in Wilmington in 1824. And this is a quote from his diary, quote, "It's Lafayette Day in Wilmington. Wagons, Dearborns, gigs, sulkies, horsemen and women, footmen and boys, all crowding to witness the entry of Lafayette." If you go on to read more of his diary, he complains because he can't get any workmen because everybody is going to see Lafayette in Wilmington. So what happens is Lafayette comes to the border up on Naaman's Road. He's escorted there by the Pennsylvania delegation where he's been visiting Pennsylvania. And the state of Delaware delegation meets him right there on the Philadelphia Pike right around Naaman's Road. And as they cross Naaman's Creek, there is an elaborate arch that extends completely over the Philadelphia Pike. There's a big portrait of George Washington and an American eagle hanging from this arch with the words emblazoned on the arch, "Delaware welcomes Lafayette." Now, imagine this scene. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people, and there's sort of a transition. The Pennsylvania delegation turns him over to the Delaware delegation. Now, the Delaware delegation is headed by Victor DuPont, who's the brother of Eli DuPont. Now, Victor DuPont knew Lafayette in France. He was actually his aide-de-camp in France. And a congressman named Lewis McLean, who is the congressman from Delaware. And they're the two sort of escorts. And there's this elaborate procession down the Philadelphia Pike. Now, Lafayette gets transferred into a carriage drawn by a team of four white horses. And then you've got a civic escort of 200 mounted horsemen. And in the primary sources, they describe them with blue coats and white pantaloons, a cavalry troop, and, quote, "a fine band of music." So you have this sort of parade coming down the Philadelphia Pike, you know, the former King's Highway, heading towards Wilmington. Now, I've got a quote here from the local newspaper at the time, the American Watchman. This is the quote. Quote, "Captain Moore's troop led the procession. The band followed. Next came the committee of arrangement in carriages, General Lafayette in an open barouche, accompanied by Lewis McLean, revolutionary officers in another barouche, George Washington Lafayette and Mr. Auguste de Levasseur in a barouche, followed by a train of carriages, all escorted by the civic guard from Wilmington. The guard, composed of mounted citizens from Upper Delaware, brought up the rear. The procession, thus arranged, moved with fine order and great effect towards Wilmington." So here's this huge procession moving down the Philadelphia Pike. Now, you can only imagine the amount of people here, and I'll get into the actual numbers here in a second, but I don't think Wilmington had ever seen anything like it. Now, here's another quote. Quote, "The road from Wilmington to the state line, a distance of 7 miles, was crowded with people on foot, on horseback, and in carriages. The scene along the whole route was gratifying and exhilarating in the extreme. Wilmington and the neighboring county poured out their population. Aged men were seen tottering under the weight of years, crowding around the carriage of Lafayette and seeking to grasp his hand. It is difficult to do justice to the spectacle which attended the general's course through the borough." Of course, Wilmington was known as a borough then. Go back to the quote. Quote, "The concourse of people assembled to witness the occasion far exceeds any number that was ever seen in this place. 10,000 or 12,000 people were in the streets, while the windows everywhere exhibited a splendid display of female beauty, arrayed in all the charms of dress. Several handsome arches were thrown up across Market Street, under which the procession passed," unquote. So it's just a mob scene, 10,000 to 12,000 people. Now remember, the population of Wilmington at this time didn't exceed 6,000. So you've got double the population of Wilmington turned out. Now, can you imagine that today? I don't know what it would take to get a crowd like that today in Wilmington. So this is incredible. So this procession proceeds down the Philadelphia Pike. By the time they get to Penny Hill, which they called Shell Pump Hill back in the day, there was a battery of cannon, 13 cannon, lined up on Penny Hill, and they all fired a salute, and that alerted everybody in Wilmington that he was coming down the hill. So then they're joined at that point by 100 mounted Freemasons, preceded by the Masonic Grandmaster. Remember, now, Lafayette was a Mason, a Freemason, and it was very important to him. And Freemasonry is probably at its peak in 1824 in the United States, and it was definitely something that in fact it's absolutely amazing. I think it was 42% of all the general officers in the Continental Army were Freemasons. So this was very important to Lafayette, and they occupied a sort of the social pecking order, a pretty high place in Wilmington at this time. So Lafayette's procession then comes down Philadelphia Pike, gets onto North Market Street, turns into North Market Street. So now they're going through Brandywine Village. And you can imagine, the streets are just packed. So what happens? He passes by 1803 North Market, the place that he had stayed 42 years earlier as a 19-year-old kid. Now
which, Joseph, by the way, is still there.
And long since died by this point. It is still there. It's still there. You can just imagine this frenzy. So there's an historian, Elizabeth Montgomery, who witnessed this parade, and she has this to say about that moment. Quote, "As he passed through Brandywine, he requested that the procession might be detained a few minutes at his son's door, at Tatnall's son's door, while he paid his respects to the representatives of his worthy friend," unquote. So what he did is he stopped the procession, got out, and embraced the family of Joseph Tatnall. This had to be just an unbelievably emotional moment for him and that family. You know, then Washington then proceeded into Wilmington. He crossed the Brandywine Bridge, which was all decorated, they say, with unbelievable flowers and pine boughs. They say a sea of women and children lined the streets. And at some point, I've got another quote, you know, from Elizabeth Montgomery, and this is really interesting. Quote, "As tears streaked down his cheeks, he confided to his hosts, 'Well, it is 42 years since I was here, and how pleased I am to return to your town again,'" unquote. And of course, he's referring to being back in Wilmington. So I don't think we have any idea the frenzy and the outpouring of just sheer joy that Wilmington turned out on that day. And I don't think there's ever been anything like it since. And all this is generally lost to history. There's not one single thing I can think of in Wilmington that commemorates this. Having 10,000 to 12,000 people turn out when your population's only 6,000, that had to be just an incredible event. So he goes down through the city. They have a parade route that takes them down French across Front Street and then up Market Street. And they stop in front of the old City Hall, which is still standing. And there's now another honor guard and another arch that they pass under. And they go upstairs on the second floor, and there's a huge banquet that's held. And all the leading citizens of Wilmington are there. The DuPont brothers are there, the mayor, which they call the Chief Burgess. And the Grand Master of Masonic Lodge made one of the 10 toasts. And I have a list of all the toasts that were made to Lafayette. And they're all pretty elaborate. But I thought this one was the most meaningful, and I'll quote it. This guy's name was J.G. Brinkle, and he's Delaware's Masonic Grandmaster. Quote, he makes this toast, quote, "We cannot forget you came to our aid through dangers and difficulties, that you entered our little army without rank, that you risked your life, blood in our battles, and in short, that you identified your feelings with those of an American patriot. There breathes not an American who does not honor the name of Lafayette," unquote. So it was quite a day. They had this elaborate dinner that was catered by the Sign of the Ship Tavern, by the way. And the toasts went back and forth, and you know, old veterans came in to see him. There were still some left, some people he remembered. Just an amazing day. He ends up the day by getting in his carriage and heading to Newcastle, where he attends the wedding of Victor DuPont's son in Newcastle. And as I said, he was very close to Victor because Victor had been his aide-de-camp in France after the American Revolution. You know, Victor Victor had not yet come to the United States. So he was very close to the DuPont family. As we'll see, he came back to visit him later. But this day was something that I don't think Wilmington has ever seen. I can't find any example in history where Wilmington would have turned out crowds like this or had such a celebration. It was amazing.
I can think of two VIP visits in the 20th century. FDR had three campaign rallies in Wilmington, and by campaign rally, meaning he stopped his train at the train station, which is now where the Acme is, and he got out and said a few words. And the newspaper articles say that maybe 20,000, possibly a little bit more, came out. And then in 1952, Eisenhower had a campaign rally, and he came and sort of drove up Market Street and then gave a speech at Rodney Square, and the newspapers say 20,000. But Wilmington's population at that time is 110 to 120,000. So in terms of portion of the population, you're right, there's nothing like it in terms of Lafayette's visit.
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to imagine double that population turning out for Eisenhower. I mean, that's, you know, when I was a kid, I remember JFK came to dedicate the, I think it was the Delaware Memorial Bridge, and it was a nice crowd, but nothing that would approach this kind of frenzy. Mm-hmm. It's amazing.
And then he comes back a second time. July 1825. Yeah. What happens there? It's the end of his farewell tour, and he comes back. He likes Wilmington so much that he comes back.
Yeah, well, he does this official visit on the 6th of October in 1824, and then he continues on to Baltimore. Actually, after Victor DuPont's son's wedding, he goes down to Frenchtown, gets on the steamship, heads down to Baltimore and Washington, other places. In July of 1825, it's at the end of his tour now, he's invited back to Wilmington by the DuPont family. So what he does is he makes his way to Philadelphia, and he takes sort of an extended rest up in Philadelphia for about 10 days. And then he boards a steamboat, the steamboat Delaware, comes down the Delaware River to the Christiana, and the DuPont brothers meet him down in Wilmington. This is kind of a low-key visit now. This is not an official parade visit like he had, you know, when he first came to Wilmington. So he's there, but now he still does some official functions. He comes in and he goes right to the Freemasons luncheon, and the lodge in Wilmington actually renames itself the Lafayette Lodge number 14, and it still exists today. It's still called Lafayette Lodge, and they honor him by giving him, of course, making him the honorary Grand Master. And I think the charter of that lodge is actually signed by Lafayette. That day he actually signs it, and they present him a wooden box, and that box is made from wood from a tree from the Battle of the Brandywine near where he was wounded. And inside the box, I guess it's got his membership, his charter to be Lafayette Lodge. So he has that little official ceremony with the Freemasons. And then what he does is he gets in a carriage, and Victor DuPont takes him to Levere's. And he actually stays at Levere's. And you know, we always think of Levere's growing up in Wilmington as a golf course out between Wilmington and Newark. But Levere's was actually the home along the Brandywine of Victor DuPont. And today, you can see the gates to Levere's right across from the DuPont Country Club on Rockland Road. There's what they call black gates. And they're actually white today, the little two little gatehouses. And that leads down to Levere's. And Lafayette passed right through those little gates and went down and stayed at Victor DuPont's house on the 25th of July. And I actually have found the DuPont family kept a log, kind of like you'd see in a hotel register. And it's called Visitors to the Brandywine, a summer of 1825, and they record all the visitors that they had at the DuPont houses, both EIs and Victors. And of course, Lafayette's name is in register, so it's for sure he was there. And I've also found a letter written by Sophie Madeline DuPont, who is the daughter of EI DuPont. She was only 15 at this time, but she got to meet Lafayette and his son, George Washington Lafayette. And in the letter, she describes all the tumult of having a visitor like Lafayette, and it's really kind of a touching letter because it's just got the mundane things that like any family would have. They had Lafayette to dinner, and they brought some of the young children down, you know, to meet him, you know, the babies. Lafayette held the babies, this kind of thing. And she actually describes in the letter where the entourage slept. And like, I'll quote it here, quote, "They all arrived in the morning and all dined at Uncle Victor's at Levere's." And then she puts in parentheses, "grand dinner de ceremonie," which is French. And I guess they were still doing some French, a lot of French traditions at that point. And she says here, quote, "General Lafayette and one of the gentlemen who accompanied him slept at Uncle Victor's." And then she goes, quote, "George Washington Lafayette and one of the gentlemen whose name was Lavasseur," that was Lafayette's secretary, "stayed at our house," unquote. So you had the entourage kind of split up. Lafayette stayed over at Levere's, and across the river at Hagley, that mansion still stands too, is where Lafayette's son, George Washington Lafayette, stayed. And what happened is the next morning, they took a carriage ride up Route 100, crossed over Smith's Bridge, which had a bridge by that time in 1825, and went up and toured the battlefield at Brandywine. So Lafayette continued to have a close relationship with the DuPonts, wrote back and forth for years, and they did some business dealings together. You know, and I guess, you know, the French community in Delaware maintained ties with him. But he had, you know, I think people will be surprised, you know, that he was actually here that many times and had such a close relationship with the DuPonts. Now, at the end of this tour, he goes down to Washington. He has dinner with the newly elected president. I think it was John Quincy Adams. And then he visits with James Monroe. And remember, James Monroe and him had served together at Brandywine. And there was a time where after he was wounded, James Monroe served as his interpreter, you know, spoke French. And then when everything is over and Lafayette has finished his 14-month tour here in the United States, he boards an American frigate named the Brandywine and returns to France. That's the end of his visit.
Lafayette dies in France in 1834. Word reaches Wilmington by way of a merchant ship coming from Europe. What's the reaction in Wilmington to his death?
He was like a native son. You know, they mourned officially and unofficially, and it's just amazing. And once again, you have this outpouring of emotion, and you just can't. It's hard for us, I think, in the present day to put ourselves in mind of what it was like then. But they closed everything down in Wilmington, and they had a funeral for him. They had a funeral procession and a memorial service for him. And I'll quote it here from the newspaper, quote, "A solemn funeral was formed and passed through the principal streets of the city in the following order: the governor of the state, the mayor, clergymen, members of the bar, masons, odd fellows, a white charger led by a groom with a chapeau, Cordwainers Society, Benevolent Society, Brandywine Coopers Association, young men between 16 and 21 years, 100 little boys dressed in white pantaloons, headed by a white banner with the inscription, quote, we mourn our loss, unquote. Military companies and citizens, 1,000 in all. All the bells in the city were tolled as the procession passed through the streets, and minute guns were fired from the revenue cutter in the Christiana, unquote. Now, minute guns were a tradition back then. They would fire a cannon every minute for any number of minutes as a sign of mourning, you know, at a funeral. But it's all the sort of artisans associations came out. I mean, here again, thousands and thousands of people in a parade for a man that died in Europe. You know, it's incredible. So I don't think we can glean what kind of impact he had on this generation and how popular he was. It's really something.
It is. To conclude this podcast, Bill, do you have a favorite story or anecdote about Lafayette that is unique or maybe new to our listeners that they might find surprising?
Yeah, there's one that I have, and this you know, this comes from his secretary Lavasseur, who actually accompanied him to Wilmington, but he accompanied him all through the United States, and during this joyous sort of farewell tour for 14 months that he took in 1824 and 1825, Lavasseur recorded all the events that happened. And there's a very obscure little incident that occurred that I think is just phenomenal, very emotional. And I've never seen it written up before. I've never seen it in print anywhere else. It's only in this primary source, and I'd like to read it. It takes about 30, 45 seconds, but it really sums up to me the kind of character that Lafayette possessed, and moreover, the character of our country, the people involved in this little vignette from Virginia where it took place. And it really says so much about Lafayette and says so much about our country. And it's an incident that was totally random. It was never planned to occur, and it makes it even more meaningful. And I'll quote it from Lavasserre. Quote, "A few miles from Norfolk, we were obliged to stop some time before a small solitary inn upon the road for the purpose of refreshing our horses. We were sitting in our carriage when the landlord presented himself, asked to see the general, and eagerly pressed him to alight for a moment and come into his house. 'If,' he said, 'you have only 5 minutes to stay, do not refuse them, since to me they will be so many minutes of happiness.' The general yielded to his entreaty, and we followed him into a lower room where we observed a plainness bordering on poverty, but a remarkable degree of cleanliness. 'Welcome Lafayette' was inscribed with charcoal upon the white wall, in wreath with boughs from the fir trees of the neighboring wood. Near the fireplace, where pine wood was crackling, stood a small table covered with a very clean napkin and covered with some decanters containing brandy and whiskey. By the side of a plate covered with glasses was another plate filled with neatly arranged slices of bread. These modest refreshments were tendered with a kindness and cordiality which greatly enhanced their value. Whilst we were partaking of them, the landlord disappeared, but returned a moment after accompanied by his wife, carrying their little boy about 3 or 4 years of age, whose fresh and plump cheeks evinced the tenderness and care with which he has been cherished. The father, after first presenting his wife, next took the child in his arms, and having placed one of his little hands in the hands of the general, made him repeat with much emphasis the following: General Lafayette, I thank you for the liberty which you have won for my father, for my mother, for myself, and for my country. While the child was speaking, the father and mother eyed the general with the most tender regard. Their hearts responded to the words of their boy, and tears they were unable to suppress proved that their gratitude was vivid and profound. Were I to judge from what I myself felt on witnessing this simple and yet sublime scene, General Lafayette must have found this one of the most pleasing moments of his life. He could not conceal his emotions, but having tenderly embraced the child, took refuge in his carriage, bearing with him the blessings of this family, worthy of the freedom they enjoyed." Unquote. So there you have an unplanned stop of an average to below average poor family who had no idea Lafayette would stop at their little inn, but had prepared for him. And just with the modesty and kindness, and Lafayette was just bowled over by it. You hear what Lavasserre said. He said that it might be the best thing that ever happened to him on the trip.
I want to thank you for doing the research that you are doing. You are making real original contributions to local history, and anytime you got something new, let's make a new podcast.
Well, I certainly appreciate it. I have fun doing it, and I think it's really important to preserve our history and share it with the next generation coming along. And thank you for what you do, Nathan.